Tonight, the existence of God. The problem that we face when we talk about the existence of God is that it's somewhat of an insult to the divinity to have to begin to discuss his existence. In fact, I think it was Soren Kierkegaard, the great theologian philosopher, who said that it is extremely dangerous to discuss in the presence of God his existence, simply because he takes an extremely dim view of it as recorded in Holy Scripture. However, be that as it may, we are forced to the position simply because on college and university campuses, in a world which is anything but friendly to Christianity or theism in particular, and hostile by every conceivable standard, it is necessary for the Christian church to proceed to give answers. Now, by answers, we do not mean final solutions to all the problems which confront us, simply because there is a marked inaccessibility to data. And therefore, one who is finite by definition is going to have one whale of a hard time trying to reach an infinite being or an infinite conclusion simply because one is limited by virtue of that finitude. And so when we start talking about an infinite being, and that is always what we mean when we speak of God in the Judeo-Christian concept, it boggles the mind, and the Christian sometimes feels at a loss. How am I going to communicate this idea? How am I going to tell somebody about a disembodied, ultra-dimensional, infinite being who possesses all characteristics of perfection beyond anything that the human mind can conceive of? No wonder the analytical philosophers of our day have turned around and said, well, after all, these statements can't really be analyzed. You're really talking about something that is metaphysical, that is beyond the world of time and space, a transcendence, and we can't analyze this. Now, quite properly, it is impossible to analyze a transcendent being. The only way that man can finally arrive at God is if God chooses to reveal himself. This is the position which Scripture gives us. But what we are going to attempt to do is to give some reasonable alternatives for the unbelief of men who claim that there is no such thing as any evidence, that we can't consider any factual data that would lead us in this direction, that we can't even conceive of a being like this, and therefore, what's the sense of even talking about it? The market is glutted today in philosophy with books on the subject of why you can't even talk about God. The reason you can't talk about him is because the concept, never mind the being, is irrelevant. Now, if we for a moment suppose that we shall ever convince an unbeliever by any series of propositions, logical thought, or inferences or inductions, that the God of the Bible exists, we are deluding ourselves. The ultimate proof, as I said before, is the revelation of God himself in time and space. What we can do is give reasons for faith. What we can do is lay out evidence. What we can do is lead people in the direction. But it's impossible, by the standards that men have set themselves, to prove anything to them at all, because they have not ruled God out of existence. By really logical processes of thought, they have defined him out of existence. And I would like to know how any intellect, however brilliant, can lick a problem where the definition excludes any possibility of explanation. You can't. And so the thing that the Christian must do is to come up with reasonable arguments, reasonable evidence, factual data, and provide this information. And then ultimately leave this in the hand of the Spirit of God, who must touch the hearts and minds of men. The philosopher has a classic weakness. He is bound inextricably to human reason and logic for the solution of problems without any real consideration of the limitation of human nature because of evil and sin. He therefore concludes that he can arrive at truth, absolute final truth, in certain areas, without any real consideration of the problem of sin. And this, of course, from a biblical perspective, is impossible, and also experientially impossible. So what we will try to do in discussing the existence of God, and even the term is questioned today by philosophers and multiple facets of unbelievers, all we're going to try and do is to look at the evidence. We had a governor in New York State a few years back whose name was Al Smith. He was the first Roman Catholic ever to run for president. And every time he was challenged by any of the people who wanted to point out something about him and his administration as governor of New York, he would say, "Let's look at the record." And then he would proceed to reel off the record of his administration. And that phrase came from American politics into our colloquial vocabulary. Let's look at the record. All you can do with the unbeliever, philosopher, psychologist, psychiatrist, scientist, or just general Joe, is to present facts and evidence. You can never, ever, by the standards which have been set up, prove something to him. There's a very interesting book that was released a few years ago and has now gone through 26 editions. It's called Science is a Sacred Cow. It's written by Dr. Anthony Standen, formerly of Columbia University, a professor in the science department. He dedicated the book to the Long Island Railroad. He said, "The longer the train was delayed, the more chapters I could write." That gives you some idea of his approach to the subject. He began by pointing out that the scientific method so admired by the philosopher who wishes to pour all truth into that mold is really not so reliable after all. And he takes about 10 or 12 chapters to show just why scientific methodology and scientism has become the proverbially religious sacred cow. And the philosopher has gone down the primrose path hand in hand with the scientist. What the scientist, says Dr. Standen, does not realize is that the moment he starts to extrapolate from his premises to a conclusion, he is no longer a scientist, he's a philosopher. And the moment the philosopher attempts to go into the world of science and demand that it confirm experientially and empirically everything so that he then can extrapolate a philosophy or an epistemology, a theory of knowledge, from it, then he commits empiricide simply because there is a fantastic gap between philosophy and science that the philosopher doesn't grasp, and says Dr. Standen, neither does the scientist. So we begin by recognizing that there are sound principles of inductive reasoning. We also recognize analogy as a valid course of study. And of course, the four formal laws of logic before whom all philosophers bow daily. What we are interested in is finding out whether or not there is a reasonable alternative to the non-existence of God as put forth today in our culture. How is it possible for us to do this? Well, I'd like to begin this way. I'd like to point out that there are standard arguments used for the existence of God. They have very impressive names: the ontological argument, the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, the moral argument, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. And you can go on with all the different forms of them from volume to volume to volume. In fact, I have a volume with me I brought along just for kicks called The Cosmological Arguments, A Spectrum of Opinion. Now, in this one book, and I easily show you 400 more just like it, the philosophers have broken down one argument for discussion, and they are still chasing the argument, and nobody's really settled except the philosopher who says, "This is the answer." And then somebody comes along in the next chapter and says, "That's not the answer." And somebody comes along in the next chapter and says, "They're both wrong. This is the answer." And then in volume two, they proceed to recapitulate why the other one doesn't have the answer. Now, if I seem hostile to philosophy, I am. And the reason I'm hostile is not sour grapes. I was an A philosophy student. I took my master's degree in philosophy at New York University under Dr. Sidney Hook, who gave me all the reasons why I shouldn't believe in God. I learned atheism and emergent naturalism from him. I'm hostile to philosophy for one basic reason. It leaves everybody hanging on a chain out in space. The chain has no beginning and the chain has no end, and you're somewhere hung in the middle. The philosopher really doesn't care. He's only interested in the particular link in the chain, which is his philosophy. Now, if you don't think that's true, simply go and analyze the whole history of philosophy from Anaximander and Anaxagoras all the way through to the present day. And you will find that they all consistently, in each school, recapitulate and then refute each other. No wonder that Tertullian, the great church father and philosopher, said, "There will never be, there can never be, any agreement between Athens and Jerusalem. Athens is the worship of human reason, and Jerusalem, the worship of divine wisdom. You can have no agreement between these two. God inevitably must triumph in his own creation. Otherwise, there's just no sense, no purpose, no meaning to anything." And that's where Jean-Paul Sartre leaves us, in No Exit. That's where Albert Camus leaves us, in his writings. The utter depravity, the utter darkness, the utter meaninglessness and purposelessness of mankind and nature. And Bertrand Russell, looking back over his life at the age of 92, said, "I see only bleakness and darkness and despair." Why? He began raised in a Christian home and then proceeded to abandon some good sound reasoning, I might add, and come to an agnosticism which left him at the end in utter despair. Now, this does not mean that there is not something good in contemporary philosophy or historic philosophy. It doesn't mean that we can't learn something. It means that we must look at it in the proper perspective of God. And the proper perspective of God is Colossians chapter 2. "Beware lest anybody ruin you through philosophy, through empty deceit and after the rudiments and basic elements of this world, and not after Christ. For in him dwells all the fullness of God in flesh." It's a marvelous statement. "For in him dwells all the fullness," pleroma, kais, theotetos, somatikos, "all that God can mean in flesh." That is incarnate wisdom. So we have a very definite position. We make absolutely no apology for it. Christianity begins with summa theologica and summa philosophia, the supreme theology: God was manifest in the flesh. Summa philosophia: God has revealed his wisdom to man, not that man may love his own mind, but the mind and being of God. Now, we have a position. Please don't go around apologizing for the fact that we're theists. That's what we are. We are theists. We believe in the existence of one God, and we believe in an eternal, disembodied, ultra-dimensional being, creator and sustainer of the universe, and savior of the world in Jesus Christ. We have a very definite position. You know, when Christians go to lecture sometimes, as sometimes I have the opportunity to do, in hostile philosophy departments, they have a tendency to go in almost apologetically, as if philosophy had refuted Christianity. And this is utterly absurd. Philosophy has succeeded magnificently, almost majestically, in refuting itself. And the Christian, therefore, ought to recognize that we have a lot more going for us experientially in terms of purpose and meaning than all philosophy combined. After all, the philosophers have never yet erected a hospital. They have never yet built any orphanages. Nobody ever went to Africa, Asia, or out into the wilds of the world and tried to present Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism. Can you imagine discussing with a cannibal with his filed teeth gleaming in the sun why there is no possibility of an exit from life and that man is in utter despair? You'd be in utter despair, all right. You'd be in a pot. The philosophers never go out and really accomplish, I'm talking now experientially and from a standpoint of axiology, values, they never accomplish these things. They are the gadflies of civilization and the parasites of the church. They live on the criticism of others and of themselves. I always say when I lecture, and sometimes I don't get any laughs, that until I see philosophy produce something concrete in terms of the ethics and morality and betterment of mankind they are always telling us we should have and should aim for, until I see it, I'm not about to believe that there's any real value in it except intellectual gymnastics. Now, I have a lot of friends who are philosophers, and they get furious when I talk this way. They invite me to their classes so they can argue with me. And I might add, it never hurts to stand up for Jesus in the context of higher education or any place else. It hurts when you don't. So I have prefaced my remarks and probably prejudiced people who will be listening to me and the tape which is coming out of this, but I have to declare we do have a position in historic Christianity. We do have a somewhat inborn contempt, historically, for philosophy which leads men away from God and very seldom ever towards Him. We love the philosophers. We are quite hostile, frequently, to the conclusions that they come to. And I might add, most of the conclusions are non sequiturs. They do not logically follow. What we have to do is analyze the facts. So, to return to Al Smith, let's look at the record. And let's look at some of the common forms of argumentation for the existence of God. And instead of placing them in the deductive framework, let's put them in an inductive framework, in, if you will, a scientific methodology. Let's take a form of an argument that a philosopher has to pay attention to, and I'll state some of those, and then analyze them and set them forth as reasonable alternatives. Now, we're specifically told in the so-called cosmological speculations, and the word cosmological is a 50-cent word, don't get thrown by it. It simply means from the fact of the cosmos, the study of the universe. That's all it means. From this particular argument, it is generally stated that since we have a universe in front of us, this is the way Christians generally state it, if we have a universe in front of us, where did it come from? It must have come from God because we can't explain it. Now, the philosopher loves that. The unbeliever loves that because then he can lead you off into contingency arguments, into infinite regression, and by the time you get finished an hour or two afterwards, you not only won't know what you believe anymore, you won't even know what the question was you asked. Now, if you doubt that, I suggest reading some of the contemporary arguments in some of the books on the subject, and you'll see exactly what I mean. So let us deal with a good inductive form of the cosmological argument. This one will stand up inductively in any philosophy department. If anything now exists, then either something must be eternal, or something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. Now you must go through that very carefully because the philosophers and the people who don't believe will analyze every word very carefully, so we must state it again. If anything now exists, and I think we're reasonably sure that that's true, then either something must be eternal or something not eternal must have emerged out of nothing, or from nothing. Now, is it more reasonable to believe that something emerged from nothing, or is it more reasonable to believe that the universe is eternal? Is it more reasonable to believe that the universe is illusory, or is it more reasonable to believe that the universe is created and therefore finite? Actually, you have about four choices, so we'll review them. First, the universe is itself eternal and is the product of chance. Well, is it true? In physics, there is a law called the second law of thermodynamics. It still stands. It holds that the universe is losing energy by heat energy by friction. So that right now, what is happening is that greater temperatures tend to lesser temperatures, and that in the end, the consummation of the universe is maximum entropy, which means cold. We have some illustrations of it in our own solar system. Pluto, Uranus, are right now encased in ice. Why? They cooled off. The sun is cooling off. The analysis of the stars, the furthest out all the way in, including quasars, tell us that we are dealing specifically with cooling processes. Therefore, we are not living in an eternal universe, because whatever tends to maximum entropy was at one point in time greater than it will be when the maximum entropy arrives. What am I saying? It's getting cold. That's all. Sounds very philosophical and very erudite when it's read and propounded page after page. What does it really mean? We're running out of energy. Now, I'm sure you understand what that means. Simply because gasoline will shortly be 50 or 75 cents a gallon. We are in an ecology crisis. We're running out of the resources of energy in our own civilization, and I might add, on Earth. And therefore, people are now beginning to consider the problem of energy. Okay? Then use this illustration when you talk to people about an eternal universe. How come we're in an energy crisis? And they will say, oh, well, because we're running out of our natural energy resources. But we shouldn't be running out of our natural energy resources. And the reason why we shouldn't is because the universe is eternal. And all things must continue. But they're not continuing. Everything is burning out, including this planet. Now, no one has ever yet refuted the second law of thermodynamics. And in the book, Dr. Einstein and the Universe, Lincoln Barnett points out that Einstein's basic argument from his own studies and his own great advances in physics led him to state time and time again, the second law stands. Everything is tending to entropy. Therefore, we are living in a circular, finite universe. And it's running down. And he concluded by saying, quote, God does not play dice with this universe. The laws are working out. Now, the philosopher says, there's no such thing as a law. It's a statistical probability. What does that mean? That means that what you think is a law really isn't a law. What it is a constant tabulation of the same thing happening all the time. Now, that's marvelously theoretical. But when it gets into the practical world, it really doesn't work out too well. Because if you drop a brick off a building 100 times, the law of gravity, statistically probable, will cause it to hit the asphalt down below. If you apply this principle to that, it is perfectly feasible that one time you will drop that brick off and it will just hang there. Now, the scientists will tell you this in physics lectures because I've heard it. But the fascinating part about it is no scientist on Earth will stand under that building while you drop the bricks. Because the statistical tabulation he believes in. And he'll talk about, and the philosopher will, it's not a law, but it's his skull on that pavement. And he's not going to do it. Therefore, you see, the human mind is marvelously diverse in that we talk about these things and project these things as arguments and hide behind them as a defense against the mechanism of God's existence, which is inbred in the soul of man because he said he put it there. But when the real chips are down, nobody stands under the building. Let's face the fact that there are laws and they operate. And Halley's Comet will be back in 1975. You can count on it if it hasn't met something along the way, because it's coming back in orbit. The universe is predictable, which, I might add, leads us to our second point. Namely, is the universe an illusion? After all, you've only got four possibilities. Some philosophers say yes. They're called solipsistic philosophers. Now, that's a big word. Do you know what it really means? A solipsistic philosopher is somebody who says, the only reality that exists is reality I perceive in my mind. And that philosopher says, and really, you can't prove anything. You can't even prove that you exist. Ever heard that argument before? Oh, it's very, very common. Of course, the argument is immediately destroyed by the fact that the solipsist is talking with you. And since he wants to maintain his own sanity, because they have places for people who think that they're talking to people who aren't there. He has a very weak philosophical argument. The best statement of it was Stasis' argument from Princeton, but even that argument was very, very weak because in the final analysis, a solipsist has great difficulty navigating across a New York City street, particularly the way the taxi drivers drive, if he believes that all reality he alone perceives, because it just may run into one of those drivers who doesn't perceive the same reality, namely him. And then you've got a real problem for solipsism, namely you're dead. That's really an irremediable problem. Is the universe an illusion? No. Halley's Comet proves it isn't. The prediction of eclipses proves it isn't. Why? Because an illusion exists in the mind of the person suffering from it. But once I can predict and can correlate this prediction from the minds of others observing the same phenomena, I know it's no longer an illusion. It's correlative truth. And it is statistically verifiable. The universe is not an illusion. Oh, sure, there are galaxies that burned out millions of years ago. I don't know anything about them. In fact, the nearest galaxy to us, if it blew up tomorrow morning, the light from that galaxy traveling to us would take 2 million years to get here at a speed of 186,000 miles per second. That's pretty far out. Well, that indicates that it's possible for us to be looking up at galaxies and think they're there, but they're not. One of the pet arguments of the illusionist. Very true. It could very well be. But in the universe I live in, there is predictability. And therefore, I can see and I can predict. And there's considerable evidence from the shift in the red shift in the spectrum and other scientific facts we don't have time to go into that there's reality way out there on the fringes of the galaxies. So the universe is not eternal because it's running down, as the old statement goes. The universe is certainly not illusory because we can predict. Is indeed the universe now something which arose spontaneously out of nothing? And we're back to our basic premise again. If anything now exists, then either something must be eternal, or something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. All right. It's the first principle of physics that from nothing, nothing derives. So if you're going to argue for a spontaneous emergence of multiple forms of energy and matter in constant interchange in vast quantity, and you are going to say that this emerged from absolute vacuum, from nothing, you are at the juncture of having to affirm more faith in an irrationality than in the belief of an intelligent being who created the laws that govern what we can observe. Now, if the Christian thinks for a moment, the Christian knows that the average mind is not going to buy the universe out of nothing, because everybody recognizes the fallacy instantly. From nothing, nothing emerges. Now, I know there are philosophers, and this may come as a shock to you, and even astronomers, who have said with a straight face that from nothing, nothing comes is not necessarily true. One of them was Fred Hoyle, who set forth the steady state theory that the universe was always exchanging energy and converting it from energy to matter and back again. Therefore, the universe was eternal. However, his theory was disproved a few years ago by his own colleagues, and then he wrote another paper. And I read the paper, and it was fascinating, particularly a sentence in it where he said that the only possible conclusion that we can now come to in astronomy, as far as he is concerned, is that the entire universe emerged spontaneously from nothing. I read it twice because I wanted to be sure I was reading the right thing, and that's exactly what it was, so help me. Now, if the Christian says, in philosophical discourse, that the universe emerged spontaneously out of nothing by a direct act of an other-dimensional being, we are crazy, irrational, and illogical. But the scientist and the philosopher will cooperate together in affirming an even greater absurdity. That within this dimension, with no evidence whatsoever, everything just appeared at 6 a.m. 12¼ billion years ago. I think that requires an enormous amount of faith, and scientists and philosophers are not supposed to have any. Remember that's a prerequisite. Faith is the substance of what is hoped for, the evidence of the intangible. A scientist proceeds from a particular instance to a general conclusion and validates it inductively by experimentation. We're going to follow a scientific method to establish the universe as emerging spontaneously out of nothing. I would like to see the data. And there is none. Therefore, it has to be rejected. And finally, the universe was created and is therefore finite. It was created by a force transcending it by infinity, and a force that we cannot observe in this time-space continuum. Now our philosopher friends come back and say, well, that force itself could have ceased to exist and the effect or the universe gone on. And so you're chasing a phantom. You can't find God there. We're not attempting to find God there. We are attempting to show that the universe is finite and that the cause for its existence is not here. And we are attempting to show that there's no evidence that any cause for this universe disappeared a long time ago. Why? Because there's such a thing as radioactive decay. And the scientist and the philosopher recognizes it. He recognizes the fact that radium has a specific half-life and that it inevitably ends up as lead. We have radioactive carbon dating, which tells us the age of fossils, and the scientists will swear by it. We have nuclear fission dating, and we have potassium-argon dating, all of which tells us the age of rocks and fossils and other things. The scientist accepts it. In accepting it, he is acknowledging that there is a measurement of time, and he ends up with a universe somewhere between 4.5 and 12.25 billion years old. And it has absolutely no evidence at all for existence on a scientific basis. Therefore, we are faced with a finite universe running down, which had to have an origin greater than itself. There's no reason to suppose that the initial cause just disappeared. And the Christian can now begin to argue what is known as causality. And a lot of people don't like that. Because the moment you talk about causality, the philosopher comes back and says, the minute you talk about cause and effect, you have to start arguing back and back and back and back and back, and even God ends up as an effect. Or perhaps as a cause caused by something else, another way of stating it. How does the Christian deal with this? Well, the Christian can deal with cosmology by pointing out very simply that the God of biblical theology is the most reasonable option of the four possibilities. We haven't proved God's existence. We have disproved the affirmations of the unbelieving philosopher and scientist that this is the way it was done. And we have arrived at a more reasonable explanation, which is perfectly in accord with what we find in Holy Scripture. Therefore, what we are saying is what we believe is more reasonable and more rational and, in the end, more scientific and logical than what you believe. And on your own grounds, we affirm it. Let's go a step further. Is there such a thing as cause and effect? Yes, there is. And we can see it all about us. Let me state causality in an inductive form. Christians don't generally do it this way, but we ought to because it's a good statement. In causality, if there now does exist a chain of causality, then either it is itself eternal as a chain, or it originated in an eternal potential cause, or it originated from nothing. I'm restating Thomas Aquinas, inductively, not deductively. What does it boil down to in common everyday language? It means that every effect has a cause. And if you start regressing from you to your parents, and if you start regressing from Earth back into the solar system, eventually you end up, the best scientists tell us, with grandmommy and granddaddy hydrogen atom. Now, nobody knows where they came from, but they were there. George Gamow points out in the Big Bang Theory that this gigantic explosion brought the universe into existence. And nobody knows where the atoms came from, but they exploded. And this is what brought the universe to what we see today.